Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Gies, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
And greetings, one and all. Welcome to another Wednesday evening with your favorite and my favorite podcast. Welcome to the Voice of Indie podcast, show number 77. I am your host tonight, as usual, Mr. Beam Weeks, and Mr. Stephen Gies is here as well, wearing two hats tonight. How you doing, Stephen?
Pretty good, and you are breaking up badly, like word. Yes.
Wow.
We have a program change, listeners. Richard W. Jenkins was scheduled to be our guest tonight, but at the last minute, he was not able to keep the date, so we shifted years, and tonight we're going to do a how-to session, point of view. And if you think you know all about point of view, I dare you to listen in, because I think we might even get into some, depending on time, some advanced stuff that you might not be familiar with yet. So tonight, we're going to talk about point of view. And how are you doing up there, Beam?
Well, I'm trying to connect to my phone here, so just a minute, and we will take care of that. Is it still breaking up?
I think so. Say something.
Hello, everybody.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and go with the phone here. I got to get rid of my earplugs.
You want to go ahead and hit your first roll in?
First roll in is, if you guys want to, hold on, I'm going to kill this. No, I can't do that. Let me take care of this. All right. So if you guys want to join in on the show tonight, you know the drill. Here's how you do it.
Call 516-453-9902 right now and join us on air or tweet us with the hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body and we'll read your comment or question live. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group.
This one's kind of a how-to session, so we do want people to call in with questions, challenges, examples, some of your favorite point of view, whatever.
Yeah. You know, I have a feeling. I know what's going on with this this breaking up. I think because last time I did that and tonight I had to turn on my printer to print off the rundown here, and I'm thinking that that might be doing something with the computer. It's off now. The last time it was on during the entire episode, so that's my guess that it might have something to do with that. And maybe after I run the computer, run the printer, I just reboot it, and maybe that'll take care of it. We'll find out next time.
Oh, well, you sound good now, kind of like a Marvin Gaye vibe.
Yeah. All right. Well, heard it through the grapevine. Well, this is my phone. So, all right. Yeah. So. You got something on the Oort Foundation?
Yeah, the Oort Foundation to the stars, the second Oort Chronicle. Any second now. I saw the eighth proof came in today. There's a couple of middle notes from the author. The covers are done. Everything's ready to go. Any second now. So watch your newsletter. Be prepared to get out there and place your pre-sale order for the second in the series that started out with Icicle, the first Oort Chronicle.
All right, so speaking of new arrivals, coming soon, The Calling Dream by Carlisle Toms. That will be arriving soon, so keep an eye out on Twitter, on Instagram, in the newsletter as well. And Eerie Charms of Fantasy, Horror, and Mystery by Patricia A. Guthrie is arriving soon as well. I edited this book, and these are some fantastic short stories. So if you're into the short stories, this is one you're going to definitely want. And if you miss an episode of this wonderful podcast and you don't want to miss one, but if something comes up on a Wednesday and you can't partake, here's where you can find all of the old episodes that you can binge spend a whole weekend and binge them all.
If you miss a show, find us in the archive in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube, on Spotify, or under the podcast tab at freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, and stephengees.com. On YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe.
Now, on March 23rd, I'm going to be a guest on the Meet the Author video podcast, which is hosted by Ron and Joan Carter, a pair of authors who write thrillers, including zombie thrillers. They've got a great little podcast, and they spend an hour meeting authors each week, and they're going to meet me on the 23rd. And that's during the one-hour period before our podcast airs on Wednesday evening. So if you're in the Eastern time zone, I'll be on their show at 7 o'clock before our show starts at 8 o'clock. And then what happens, Beam?
And then it's crossover time. That's right. Immediately following that, the Carters will join us on the Voice of Indy in the usual time slot that we're on. So keep an eye out on in the newsletter for the details.
Stay on top of these podcasts and all things Fresh Ink Group with our weekly digital newsletter, new releases, videos, stories, excerpts, interviews, and more. Sign up now on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com and be the one who knows what's what.
What? Mm-hmm. That's going to be a fun time. Definitely.
Yep.
Now, you guys already know who this guy is, our guest tonight. Stephen Gies earned his undergrad and grad degrees at the University of Michigan. Boo! Go State! Michigan State! Woo-hoo. A composer, TV producer, publisher, graphic artist, and writer, he focuses now on novels, essay collections, short fiction, authors how-to under the Gies Writer brand, and scripts. Founding member of the publisher Fresh Ink Group, he works with a wide variety of authors to produce their best possible work. Watch for his essays, stories, books, and blog posts at stephengies.com. Find him and his author friends at freshinkgroup.com and send him a note from his member page or the contact page. Welcome again, Stephen. Change your hat and put on the guest hat now.
All right. Well, thank you. I've been wanting to get on this podcast for a while, but y'all never invite me.
Well, you know, we're busy.
So, listeners, point of view. We've not really talked much on this podcast about Gies Writer. Gies Writer is actually something that I set up a long time ago, decades ago, to be a resource for writers so that they can get information, find experts, get help, hook up with editors or beta readers, whatnot. And it's got its own website, GiesWriter.com. That's GiesWriter, like it's one word, GiesWriter.com. All kinds of cool stuff over there. I also have started publishing a series called Gies Writer How-Tos for Writers. Now, way back in the day when I used to do volunteer class teaching in story writing skills, I developed, I don't know, like at least 15 or 20 units on different topics. In fact, I'm looking over at the shelf right now, and I've got a foot-high stack of folders full of all that material. And I started putting them together in digital ebook form and got four or five out, something like that, and then got distracted, you know, working on Robert G. Willis Croft alone writes a book about every 2 weeks. So that kind of stuff keeps me busy. But get over there to Amazon where they're available in Kindle. Gies Writer How To. And there's four or five topics there. And, you know, if there's enough interest in them, I can start putting out more because I've got the material. But our topic today is point of view. Point of view is something that really started becoming important in modern literature 40, 50 years ago. In the last 20 or 30, it has really come to the forefront. Way back when I first wrote this material, I referred to point of view shifting, where you shift from one point of view to another. Since then, there's a popular term called head hopping, which
head
I'm starting
hopping.
To see, starting to see all over the place, which basically means the same thing, where you hop from one character's head into the other character's head. So whether you call it shifting, head hopping, or, you know, late for supper, whatever it is, it's not cool, frowned upon, considered amateurish, and will likely get, you know, monkeys at the zoo will throw poo at you when they find out that you were doing that kind of stuff.
Let me add something to that. When I start reading a book and I find that, I usually stop right there and I don't finish it. Just let people know.
Yeah, well, and I'm that way too. I mean, amateur point of view use making all of the mistakes in the point of view conventions really, really can be jarring, distracting, can take you out of the story. It's just, and then once you become sensitive to it and know what you're looking for and see the mistakes, then it's just so distracting, it's almost not worth trying to finish the story. So point of view is something that's got just some basic rules around it, and then what I call conventions, meaning that's it's the way it's done. There's not like a Chicago Manual of Style saying that you have to do a certain thing with point of view, but it's the way modern literature does it, and if you break too much from those conventions, then that's what messes people up. Now, when I teach these classes and people give me stuff and I start giving it back to them saying, well, you know, you got 3 points of view in this paragraph here. No, you can't do that. Don't make me report you. Then, you know, they usually kind of get taken aback, like, well, why not? Well, who says, you know? And the readers are the ones that are ultimately going to say. But the thing about point of view is there's some basic conventions that you really need to learn and get in the habit of using. And once you get in the habit of those, you'll start seeing it not as limiting, not as, oh, I have to do it this way, I'm stuck doing it that way, but as opening up all kinds of new possibilities for you. Because when you don't constantly have to remind people, hey, I'm an amateur and I don't know whose point of view I'm in, so every time I'm in somebody's head, I'm going to have to tell you whose head I'm in and constantly keep reminding you and keep distracting you with all that kind of stuff, you start to learn that when you learn how to finesse this kind of stuff, you just set it up. The readers know where you are, and then you can run. You can have fun. You can do all kinds of cool, creative stuff without being bogged down with all of those details. So please don't see this as like, oh, it's the rules and, you know, we're supposed to do it this certain way. See it as if you get in the habit of doing it a certain way, it opens up unlimited creative possibilities for you. Would you agree with that, Bea?
I would agree 100%. Like I said, that's a distracting thing when I start reading that. I mean, there are some stories that have, you know, I've gotten halfway through it, you know, trying to work around it. But after a while, even that is just, you know, so usually right off the bat, if I see it, I'm done with it. We do have some comments over on Twitter real quick here. Let's see here. We got Robert G. Willis Cross. He said, POV, one of my favorite hangups. He also threw a correction out there. Ort Federation, not Foundation. That's what the rundown said, Foundation. But you know,
did I say
the
Foundation?
Rundown. Yeah, we had to put, but we crammed this in the last minute because we had a guest that dropped on us and we were rushing around trying to make some changes all for the last few days. And this rundown didn't get finished until about 20 minutes before showtime.
And the printer was still turned on.
Burwayne Greenhoe says, it's good to see y'all tonight. It was about 72 here in Madison, Florida today, but Sunday will only have a high of 55 only. Come on, dude. Life goes up and down. The wife and I are here and ready to learn from the one and only Stephen G. All right. And then there's another Verwayne and Dr. Helen, if you would like to take that, Stephen.
This one says, Stephen G., please post a link to that show in the newsletter that comes out on Wednesday morning. P.S. Go Blue, laugh out loud. Yeah, he got you back on
go
that
green.
One. Yeah, we'll definitely do that. In the newsletter that comes out on the morning of March 23rd, we'll have the link to the video show and to our podcast as well. So you can try to see them both in if you want. And then you got a comment there from Helen?
Yeah. Reading varied works of Pubbers, Stephen G's is an adventure into divergent worlds. First, as a laid-back reader enjoying his verbal playfulness. Second, as a dedicated pubbed writer admiring his literary mastery, see my review of his short stories at Book Bites. Yeah, that one's always thrown
yeah.
me. Book Bites.
Book Bites by Burrell.
And Bites is B-Y-T-E-S. Book Bites by Burrell, B-O-R-E-L. So, yeah, she's got a review of Comes This Time to Float, isn't it? Yeah,
several books. I think she did Fantasy Patch and a couple of others too.
Nice.
But so let's roll a commercial here.
Okay.
You know, I had the Ghost of Isaac Asimov over for lunch today, so that's why Foundation was on my mind. But if I don't get a Willis Cross title wrong, it's not a podcast. So let's go ahead and see if we can get the title right in the new commercial for the Ort Federation.
Now, speaking of Bulletcrop, he just threw another one out here. He's on Twitter. He said, we have freezing rain that has made the streets a black ice mess. We're with you there, Robert G. Bulletcrop. We've had, better, 5-degree weather, and then at nighttime it dips well below zero. So, it's wintertime.
I got to say, it was 64 here, and my hibiscus leaves are starting to pop. But,
All right. This is the second Ort Chronicle.
As the Ort Federation becomes a major force in the solar system, Braxton Thorpe passes the Federation chairmanship to former U.S. President John Butler. Thorpe's group offers humanity virtual immortality, but Isidore Orlov and his Udakhni Enterprises oppose their every move. While terraforming Mars for more living space, the Mars Reds prove formidable as resistors. If the Asterian Starship fighter pilots are released, will they align with Phoenix or Udakhni? And who will develop the right FTL technology? In this tense space adventure, Thorpe, his team, and Max the Tabby Cat travel to Proxima Centauri and beyond to the Aster system, 84 light years distant. Will Thorpe bring together humans and Asterians in their quest for intergalactic travel? Will long life prove more than mere humans can handle? Grab Icicle, a Tensor Matrix, the first Ort Chronicle, and continue the journey with the Ort Federation to the stars. Proudly published in all print, digital, and sensory-enhanced audiobook by Fresh Ink Group.
All right.
Right. So, point of view. What I'm going to do today is just kind of quickly cover some of the basics that are in the G's Writer How-To called Point of View, and then give you a couple of examples of some of the more advanced techniques. I can't begin to touch on all of this or to get into any kind of depth with any of it. So we're just going to kind of trip through this, do quick highlights, and it'd be really cool if somebody would call in with a question or a comment or a good example of some point of view that they've seen. But go get the book. I mean, it's like $2 or $1, something like that, over on Amazon. And there's a lot of cool stuff in there to read. And there's also assignments. There's two sets. Yeah, like a set of three assignments and a set of four assignments. If you really want to try some things out, stretch your skills and do some stuff, go ahead and do the assignments and send them to me. I will definitely give you some feedback. But if you go get that book, the opening paragraph here explains what point of view is. I'm going to go ahead and just read that paragraph, and then we'll start talking. Point of view means narrative deliberately reflects the viewpoint of a particular character, usually someone in the story, sometimes a non-participant whom you designate simply to be aware of the story. POV proves a bit easier and a lot more obvious if the narrator speaks first person. However, POV is at least as important, probably even more so, when your story is narrated in the third person. You'd be surprised how many people really didn't get that POV works the same way, no matter what person you're in. In both forms, your narrator is privy to all interior elements of the POV character. The narrator experiences, and thus may describe any or all of, everything sensed by the character, what he sees, hears, smells, tastes, feels, and experiences. Your narrator possesses the POV character's full range of knowledge from past history to current level of education and understanding. Your narrator is privy only to that character's thoughts, beliefs, and interpretations, the way he thinks. Your narrator is limited to knowing and understanding only what the POV character knows about events occurring in the plot, regardless of how much the author wants to reveal from outside the POV sphere of awareness. Written with finesse, your narrator also will relay information as if directly experiencing the emotional tenor of that character, from surprise to outrage to confusion to grief and more. These are only the basics, but even within these, you will discover unlimited creative possibilities in your own work, and you will better recognize impressive, sometimes humbling, examples in the works of others. Man, I can't stress that enough. Beam and I both collect examples of point of view that just knocks us over. You know, I'm sitting here looking at the shelf here, and some of these books on my shelf are here because the point of view was exquisite. Here's The Orphan Game by Ann Darby. Man, The Orphan Game's got a scene in it where her 15-year-old brother narrates his own death in the first person.
Yes, I remember that scene. Man, that was fantastic.
Man, extremely powerful. And the way she chose to do it is the only way that would have worked, you know?
Yeah, even as the windshield's cracking, he's got this idea that he wants to draw that because he was an artist, you know? And that was just cool. I mean, fantastic.
Yeah. And he's feeling the pencil in his pocket penetrating his abdomen that's about to kill him. I mean, wow. It's something. But, you know, we mentioned in our movie episode recently, the movie American Beauty is an example where the main character narrates his own death, even though he's already dead, narrates his own death at the end of the movie in a way that's its point of view. It's nothing but looking at that and finding a way to craft and finesse the point of view to tell that story in the most compelling possible way. And like I say, Beam and I both, we really appreciate this. And when we see examples, we're always, you know, sharing them with each other. Oh, check what this person did. And it's not something that you master. It's something that you learn your entire writing career. You just get better and better at it. You find techniques. You see examples. You catch that example of the 15-year-old boy narrating his own death. And you may never use that kind of technique in your own writing ever. But maybe 20 years from now, you'll be writing something, and that kind of technique is what would work. And now you've got that experience. You've got that knowledge. So point of view. So point of view conventions. I've mentioned that a couple of times, and that's basically how is it done? What do readers expect from their writers doing their point of view? And the most basic one of all is what we talked about earlier, point of view shifting or head hopping. And that's that when you have a point of view character and you're in that character's point of view, you need to stay in that character's point of view for the entire scene, if not the entire chapter or section or even the entire book. But never, never change to a different character's point of view within a scene. Now, I just mentioned the Orphan Game. The Orphan Game's got one scene where this all this stuff's happening in the house, and mom's in the kitchen, and she's listening to the conversation, and dad's doing something, and the teenage daughter's involved. And they get to the point to where, in order to tell us what everybody is interpreting, they have to keep hopping around to the different points of view. So Ann Darby put a scene break virtually between every paragraph just to keep breaking those scenes up, to keep showing us where the point of view shifts are so that it would not be clumsy and awkward. And it worked. And, again, she's got a spot on my shelf over here.
That's when I got to grab. I've got to grab a copy that I used to have a copy. And in fact, I may still in one of my boxes down in the basement, but I might go over to Amazon after this show and grab another copy.
Yeah, I do that myself. I get to thinking about a book, and it's like, man, I got to have that on my shelf. So anyway, here's an example. Levi looked across the room and noticed that his blind date appeared to have dressed in a hurry, not even bothering to match her outfit. But she was thinking he looked uncomfortable in that silly suit. And anyway, she did not want to dress up and send him the wrong message. Now, I heard two different points of view in that. Started out in Levi's point of view. He looked across the room. He noticed that his blind date appeared to have dressed. You see, those are all words that give away the fact that he's interpreting. We're looking through his eyes. We're seeing what he sees. But then the second half of the sentence is, but she was thinking he looked uncomfortable in that silly suit. There's your head hop. We hopped out of his head and into hers. And it doubled down. She did not want to dress up and send him the wrong message. Again, you have to be in her head to know what she wants. That's way deeper than just observing, you know, she's standing over there by the water cooler. She's standing over by the water cooler thinking about what she wants. And if we're not in her point of view, all we can do is guess as to what she wants.
Good point. Good point. Listen, readers, or listeners, hopefully there's readers in our listenership. If you have questions or comments, we're inviting you to call in 516-453-9902. Or hashtag Freshing Group in a tweet, and we will see it. So, come on. We're looking for participation. Now's the time.
Yeah. Verwayne Greenhill says, I think the best POV effort I've ever done was in Finding Myself Again. Way to get that pitch in there, Verwayne. Finding Myself Again by Verwaine Greenhoe. Excellent story. I highly recommend it.
Indeed.
Now, one of the first questions that I get when I start talking about point of view is, well, how many points of view can I have in my book? And the answer is, there's no limit. If you can finesse a story with 40 different points of view and engage your readers, keep them interested, and help everybody keep all those characters straight, more power to you. It's just that as a general rule, you're probably not going to have anywhere near that many. For the most part, a lot of books will have 1, 2, or 3 points of view. It's not an uncommon practice to have like the hero and the villain are alternating points of view. And then maybe you have extra characters or other things going on in the story and you have to go to somebody else's point of view to see those.
Yeah, I usually do the one person, the one character's telling the story from start to finish. I have written a couple of things where one chapter, it's one character, next chapter, it's another character. But that's just stuff that I haven't even released any of that stuff. But the one character, I mean, that's just where I'm comfortable with it, and it's a great way to, you know, tell a story.
Now, and you use the word described, too, which suggests first person, the character telling his own story. But again, everybody, you got to remember, even in third person, point of view works precisely
the
same way.
Yeah.
Absolutely the same way.
Yeah. The Secret Collector, that's one of the novels, my work in progress that I'm working on. I got two of them. The Secret Collector, that's the third person. It's written in the third person, but it's one point of view throughout the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you start getting more and more familiar with this, too, it helps you start structuring your whole story, too. You know, when someone says, well, how many points of view can I have? You know, usually my reaction is, well, how many do you absolutely need? Because you really don't want to clutter it with a lot of extras. But consider the possibilities. My book, Fantasy Patch, is written in the first person, second tense. I mean, it's present tense. I mean, so the person telling the story is telling it as it happens, and he's the main character in the story, and he's the only person who talks in the entire book, so it is never outside of his point of view. If it happens and he's not there, we don't get to find out about it until he finds out about it. Now, conversely, my book, Papala Skies, again, has one point of view, the main character, and she is not narrating the story herself. It's all in the third person, so the third-person narrative describes what she thinks, how she feels, what she's experiencing, what she knows, all that kind of stuff. But then our shifts are between scenes in chapters back and forth in time. She might be 24 years old in this scene, and the next scene, flashback to 13. The next scene, back to 24 again. So it's always her point of view, but it's her point of view as a 13-year-old in some scenes, and her point of view as a college graduate in others. And they are different points of view because there's so much of that that's the same that overlaps. But if you think you have the same viewpoint and the same world knowledge you had back when you were 13, you're not paying attention. So you can do it that way as well. Now, you get books like Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible. That's written in alternating chapters. There are four narrators, and each narrator gets a chapter. And when you get through four narrators, chapter 5 starts over again with the first one and goes back to repeating them again. And
There's five narrators. There's the mother, the oldest daughter, the twin girls. Each have their own narrative. And then the little Ruthie, the 5-year-old, who passes away midway through the book. And they're all distinctive points of view as well.
Yes, and the narrator speaks in the voice of the person who's narrating that particular chapter as well. So when it's the young girls, then they're talking like young girls, telling the story from their interpretation as young girls. My book, Dance of the Lights, alternates between, you know, Beverly, Frank, and Kevin are the three main characters, plus there's a few other characters that are involved in scenes where those characters aren't present. And when your point of view characters aren't present, you're going to have to come up with a new point of view, because otherwise we got no way to show the readers what's happening there. So I strongly encourage you to buy every Stephen G's novel and read all of them and read all the short stories and compare all the points of view techniques and then buy an extra set and give them as gifts as well.
Yeah. Plug, plug, plug.
All right. So.
There's a comment here on Twitter real quick. Robert G. Williscroft, he says, I have found that seeing things from Max the Tabby Cat's point of view from time to time has added extra interest to several scenes in Icicle and the Oort Federation.
Yeah. So. And since we started putting him in the commercials, meow, now he wants his own trailer. He wants us to pay for his headshots. I mean, it's starting to get out of hand here.
That crazy cat.
In fact, you know, if I do a long version of this, you know, like a 3-hour version teaching to a class or whatever, we have a little bit of fun with animal point of view because there's different ways that you can do that. And that's also a very popular thing to do. So then,
we have a phone call.
Oh,
you want to take a call?
Sure.
All right. Hello, caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Good evening, gentlemen. This is for Wayne. I'm calling from Madison here in Florida.
Hey, Verwayne.
Hi, Verwayne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. Just curious, of all the points of view, which do you think is the most difficult to use?
Most
and
difficult
why?
To use? First-person narrative. And the reason why is because you can be a writer who sounds like your own writing, and you can write all of your novels sounding like the same writer who does all of his own writing, and that's your narrative voice. You can change your narrative voice like I do with every book. I try to have different narrative voices. Most writers don't do that. They try to keep developing their own narrative voice over time. So when you're telling the story about, you know, Bill the banker, and you're telling it in your own voice, then you can talk about Bill and his thoughts and his feelings and his knowledge and his experiences, and you can tell us what's happening in the plot, and you can tell us your way. But if you're going to switch to first person and have Bill the banker tell his own story, then you have to think like Bill the banker and talk like Bill the banker, and that is a lot harder to do than most people realize. Because when you're writing the dialogue in a third person narrative, you got to get Bill the banker's words right, the way his cadence, the words that he chooses, the phrases he uses, his, you know, reflective of his background and his prejudices and things like that. When you're doing the entire book that way, you got to be on your toes. Every paragraph, every line, you got to be thinking very carefully about how would Bill the banker say this? How would Bill the banker feel about this? How would he interpret this? So I think just right off the bat, the difference between the first person and the third person is it's a lot trickier to get the first person right because you're a lot more limited. You've got to get that character's narrative right on the money, whereas you've got a lot more flexibility when it's your own narrative because what you like is what you like. Did that answer, Verwayne?
Yeah, I got a good – yeah, I think I picked that up. Do you – I think I have three of your how-to books, and what is the specific name of the one point of view? I couldn't find it on Amazon.
Called Cheese Writer How-To Point of View.
I don't see that one here on, I'm going to do a specific search for that. Because I have three of yours, and I want to find that fourth one.
Looking myself.
There it is.
Yeah.
My gummy.
Yeah,
right.
There it is.
It's
the blue one.
The blue one. Okay.
And the cover is in today's newsletter as well. Cheese Writer How To, Point of View.
I just hit buy with one click right now. I now
and
own that book. So.
And it's $1.99. Financing is available.
All right. And I send you 50 cents and then 50 cents next year. And
there you go.
With the credit, Jack.
So
I just purchased it and picked it up.
Now, many times over the years, I have received manuscripts from people that are just full of that head hopping and all that kind of stuff. And then that gets down to, well, how do you fix this stuff? You've already written your story, and you've made some choices here that turned out not to be real conventional in terms of point of view. And there's a whole bunch of different tricks. I'll tell you just a couple of quick ones that are fairly easy. This one's called point of view splitting. Okay? You're trying to have a scene like say it's a blind date, and you really want the readers to know what's going on in his head, and you want the readers to know what's going on in her head. You understand that with point of view convention, you can't just be constantly jumping back and forth. So a good way to do that is just to have it in one person's head up to a certain point in the scene, and then scene break, and then pick up the scene right there, right after the scene break, but in the other point of view. For example, he stepped inside, waited for his eyes to adjust to the dark interior, then scanned the room until he spotted her. Wearing a red coat per their plan, she sat at the end of the bar looking beautiful. Now, you notice looking beautiful, things like that, he's interpreting. I'm choosing words here that tell you his state of mind. Blind date number 17, and finally, he did not have to resist the urge to turn and flee or come back with a chew toy for the mutt of the week. Her eyes sparkled as he introduced himself, and for the first time, he did not stumble over his words. This newfound confidence and unfamiliar sensation to be savored. He held her hand delicately, then, as if the natural thing to do, brought it to his lips for a gentle kiss. He could marry this girl, that much he already knew. Scene break. Now let's jump into her head and pick it up from there. Oh, gross. She hated premature physical contact, and already he was planting a slobbery kiss on her hand before she could pull it away. She quickly searched for signs of open herpes sores while he yammered on nervously about how nice she looked, his awkward nervousness palpable. He grabbed her elbow and roughly steered her toward a booth without asking, as if she had any interest in yet another take-charge kind of guy. 5 god-awful blind dates in a row, each worse than the last, and already this one promised to set a new low. Did you get 2 different points of view out of that?
Yes.
So you see, just split it. Take the scene up to a certain point, scene break, and then come back and pick it up from there. Now, most writers will tend to go somewhere else, you know, to tell us what's, you know, meanwhile back at the ranch, and then we'll come back and pick up the blind date again, and this time be in a different point of view. But don't be intimidated by that. You can split it right smack in the middle of the scene, and you can do it multiple times if you need to. Now, here's another example. This one's called point of view rewinding. This is where you play out a scene or a portion of a scene in one point of view and then back up and replay the scene, but from a different point of view, usually with a very different interpretation. One of my favorite writers who was really good at that and used a lot was Elmore Leonard. And one of the best examples, if you watch the movie Jackie Brown that was made from one of his novels, you know, when they're pulling the con and they're leaving the thing in the dressing room in the store or whatever, that scene keeps rewinding and replaying so that you see in the background, you'll see her come into the store, and then we'll replay it again and you'll see that she's leaving the store and you know, the different things are happening. But what you find out that way is each of them has a different plan. So while there's one plan going down, it's actually 3 different people with 3 different plans. And the only way we're going to know that is to rewind and look again from a different point of view. So,
yeah. And, you know, Pulp Fiction does the same thing. It's the same scene from different points of view, but at different times.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of that. You still there, Verwain?
Oh, yes.
Have you, can you think of a movie or TV show or whatever that's done that kind of stuff?
I'm trying to think. I had one in there, and then I was sitting there trying to think the name of it. But I know several where everything is constantly this guy's view, that guy's view, and it just moves down through the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And but what you're talking about is interesting. And I, like I said, I've now owned all 4 of those books. I'm going to go through them one by one, make my notes.
All right. Now, I'm an outliner. And I make no secret of that. You know, I've gone through the therapy, joined the groups and all that, and I can now publicly state it. I'm a hardcore outliner. I like to be thoroughly organized and make all my decisions, not all of them, most of them, most of the important ones up front so that I know what to expect when I'm actually working on stuff. I don't like to get to chapter 23 and decide, he can do that with a roll of scotch tape that's in the drawer. And that means that you got to back up to some earlier chapter and put that scotch tape in the drawer so that it's there and doesn't feel contrived later. And with outlines, you can organize that kind of stuff. Now, one of my favorite things to do with outlining, when I get the whole thing organized in terms of what are the main plot points that are going to happen in order, a lot of times I've got them broken up into chapters by then. Go through and look at your outline and decide every scene, whose point of view is that scene going to be in? And when you're looking at your outline and you've got your point of view notes, like maybe down the left side or however you want to do them, highlight them different colors for different characters, you can see what the flow of point of view is. And you'll start noticing that it's like, well, wait a minute, I got three chapters in a row here where we're never in my hero's point of view. Well, people want to be in your hero's point of view. That's the main character. And that outline can help you see that flow in such a way that it's like, wow, I need to get back into my main character's head some more here. And, you know, this secondary character who's going to be really important in these later chapters, I need to look for a couple of places in the earlier chapters to get into that person's point of view so that we understand what his thoughts and motivations are so that when it comes time for him to make that important decision in the plot, it will make sense to us. So for those of you who are outliners, that's terrific. It's a great way to help organize your point of view as well. If you're a pantser, and you're just writing as you go along and kind of thinking of the story as you go, even then, still look for opportunities to vary those points of view as much as you can, and don't be throwing extra ones in there that you don't need. If you've got your hero in a scene, try to get that hero's point of view in that scene as well. So we got a call?
We do have another caller. Verwayne, did you have another question or comment?
I'm a pantser, but I keep floating notes underneath my manuscript so that if I need to go back and refer to something, I have those notes at the end of the story as it goes. The story continues and the notes continue right below it. But I like that what he was saying.
Kind of like
I understand you, Stephen. So pantsing with notes.
Pantsing with notes.
Thank you,
okay,
gentlemen.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, Verwayne.
Yeah, thanks, Verwayne.
Okay, hello. Hello, caller. You are on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Josh, Wichita.
Hi, Josh from Wichita.
Hi, Josh.
Welcome to the show.
Hi. I had a couple of questions, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Sure.
The first one was, Stephen, could you define what a scene break is? Explicitly, just so that I'm completely clear on how to do one.
Okay. When you're reading a novel, a scene break looks like a double space. You know, you're going down your text, and every new line is text, and then when you get to one to where there's a double space in there, and you've got some white space in between them, the author has put a scene break there. It's shifting to a different
okay.
character's point of view, to a different location, or something like that. Now, in printed novels, scene breaks can sometimes fall at the top or bottom of a page, so they'll put symbols in there. You know, they'll put like three asterisks or, you know, three little birds or something like that to indicate a scene break. So you'll see a lot of books where most of the time the scene breaks are just double spaces, but at the bottom or top of a page there'll be a symbol or something that does that. Now that we're in the age of wrappable text and digital files and whatnot, Fresh Ink Group, we're just putting scene breaks everywhere there's a scene break. And if they fall on the page or at the top or bottom or in the middle, it doesn't matter because odds are that, you know, that file is going to be looked at on a different device or in a different way in the future anyway, and that way the scene breaks will travel. But it's usually shifting scenes, going to a different location or a different character's point of view or whatever. Pay attention to that. Pull out a couple of novels off the shelf, flip through them. When you see those double spaces, look at why that double space is there, and you'll see that you've just concluded a scene and then gone somewhere else or to another time or, like I said, to another character or point of view. So okay. You had another question, too?
Yes, I did. I was wondering, you said that you could have up to an unlimited amount of points of view. You mentioned 40, but is there any particular number that you feel most comfortable with to get a more direct novel that kind of cuts through everything and is very clear?
The lower the better.
Yeah,
several of mine, it's a single point of view for the entire book. For most short stories, you're going to get a single point of view for the entire story. I've seen some short stories, and I've written a few where you shift back and forth into some different points of view with scene breaks. And we're working on Patricia A. Guthrie's Eerie Charms right now, and I just made some Eerie Charms scene breaks, little visual things to put in there, and she's got scene breaks within the short stories as well. So as a general rule, if your entire story can be from your main character's point of view, great. Depends on what kind of story it is. If it's, like it's a superhero, for example, you're going to want to, your readers and your viewers are going to want to spend time in the person who needs help point of view as well. Because, you know, Spider-Man or Superman's got to go save the damsel. We want to get to know the damsel. And we want to know the damsel's, motivations. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And there's got to be some story there, too, because good storytelling is always raising the stakes. It's not, is he going to go save her in time so that she can, get to McDonald's before it closes. It's, to save the world or to save the person she's in love with or something like that, raise those stakes. So I'd say one, if you can. Two is excellent if you can go back and forth between the antagonist and the protagonist. And it's not uncommon to have three. Antagonist, protagonist, and the person who's most important in terms of what the result of the story is going to be. But again, I'm getting ready to put out two books in my Rich Mr. Fix series. I'm open by springtime, and in those I've got maybe 8 or 10 points of view in each of those stories because there's things happening in different places with different characters, and you can't put all your characters in the same room every time just because you want one guy to be able to know what's happening. So that's when you have to pick another point of view. I guess that's my answer is the lower the number, the better, but have a reason.
Okay. Makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, we got another caller, so let's go ahead and take this one.
Okay.
As soon as it stops spinning, there we go. Hello, caller. Welcome to the show. You are on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi there. This is Barbara Johnson, B.A. Johnson, calling from Huntsville.
Hi, B.A.
Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. Glad to have you on the air with us.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thank you. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
I'm making steady progress with my hands.
Oh, very good, very good. Thanks for having this segment on. I regret that I missed the first part of it. However, I do have this book, Point of View. I know I kind of ran into that problem with my first book. So, and you were trying to walk me through how to make sure the point of view were correct in the first book and everything. So I decided to get this book to help me with the second one. So I've read it, and I'm trying to put those things that you've suggested in the second manuscript so we won't have that problem again. I can listen to you all day, tell me about how to make sure the point of view is correct, but having it in writing, I'm a visual learner, so I appreciate your putting this in book form and text form so that I can read it and refer back to it whenever I need to. So I just wanted to let you know that I appreciate the book that you've written, this one as well as the one on dialogue. That's very good as well. So I just wanted to say hello and to thank you for putting this information in writing.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. You're welcome. See you guys.
That was B.A. Johnson, the author of Sassy Discovers the AME Church, which is an excellent book.
We have a whole bunch of tweets over here, so I'm going to knock down a couple of these.
Knock them all down.
All right. Robert G. Williscroft, a couple of them here from him. He says, in Heinlein's The Number of the Beast, not to be confused with Iron Maiden's The Number of the Beast, he presents the story in the first person, but each chapter is narrated by one of five or six characters, thus several first-person POV. Then he says, the books in my Mac McDowell Mission series are excellent examples of effective first-person narratives. At least I think so. Yeah. And Samuel Wilson, he says he's got a question. He wants to know, what is your favorite POV to write with and why? I think
Ooh.
That was, yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. Definitely first person. And it's odd because I almost never write in the first person. But, yeah, definitely the first person. When I did a fantasy patch, Fantasy Patch was a character who did things that are very similar to what I used to do as part of my career. And a lot of people read that and thought, well, that character is you. And actually, it's not, because there's two characters that are both pieces of me. And I kind of split them apart and then had them be foils and work off of each other. But in a case like that, even where the character was similar to me, I still wanted that character to be different in very identifiable ways. So I was always looking for those ways to work in a little bit of information, a little bit of style, and things like that in order to do that. But for the most part, if you're going to write in the first person, you're channeling a character. And, you know, talk about method acting, method writing, you know.
Method writing, definitely.
Yeah, you're just going to be that character until this thing gets written. And
And people don't understand that. That's a literal thing, method writing. I mean, as Stephen just said, you're channeling these characters. I've never written a character based on myself, so I've got to channel all the characters that I've ever written. And it's work making them different, unique, little quirks and things about them and whatnot.
That question was from our teenage media guy, Samuel Wilson.
Yeah, he's the guy that sends you the newsletter every Wednesday morning. He puts that together and sends them out. Robert Williscroft also has a couple of other quick little comments. He says, I think using a scene break symbol is mandatory in today's world.
Yeah, they're definitely ubiquitous in e-books now. I'm still seeing a lot of print books coming out where they're only using that double space, though. It will change. It will continue to evolve over time.
And here's some more Robert G. Wolfcroft and some more shameless plugging, which we love. My Orc Chronicles are epic stories with a large number of players. Many are sufficiently important to the story that we need to see the action near them from their point of view. This results in many points of view presented in a logical sequence that flows with the story.
Yeah, and Robert, I don't know how much of it that you're actually planning your point of view sequences or if it's just, you know what you're doing. And I suspect it's a lot of the latter because you can feel it. You know, that pacing is important. If you're spending a lot of time in one point of view and neglecting the other one after spending a lot of time setting up that point of view, you'll feel it as a writer. Your readers will feel it. And, you know, that pacing, that mix, that going to back and forth, you know, you'll get that example where you've got one character and there's only one scene in the whole book that's going to be in that character's point of view, but you need to see what's happening where that character is. You know, that's when you start to think, can I put another character there? You know, can I change this scene a little bit so that I don't have to spend a single point of view on one character? But for the most part, yeah, Robert G. Williscroft books flow very well with going back and forth between the different point of view characters. And that's dovetails nicely with the pacing of the plot, too, because you're pacing your point of view and your plot together. And if one of them gets out of whack, they're both out of whack.
Yeah. Nothing worse than an out of whack story.
So you want to play another commercial?
Sure thing.
We might as well promote some of my books.
This is Stephen's short story collection called Come, It's Time to Flow.
Prepare to think as you explore these 19 short stories by author, composer, and producer Stephen Gies. Avoiding any single genre, this collection showcases Gies' storytelling from literary to Southern Gothic to coming of age, allegory, humor, and even fantasy, all finessed to say something about who we are and what we seek. Some of these tales have been passed around for years, others so virgin they have never known the seductive gaze of a reader's eyes. Now, you can go digital, Kindle, Nook, Kobo, iTunes, Google Play, and more, or you can keep it soft with a paperback to whip out in mixed company. Or you can really show off, be the envy of your crowd with a dust jacket and hardcover. Fresh Ink Group is where it's coming from. Amazon and the rest are where it's at. Just point and click, and you too can feel the electric surge of the latest from Stephen Gies. So when life's currents get to pulling too hard, don't fight it. Just open the book and discover 19 new ways of going with the flow. Because now, more than ever, comes this time to float.
I've read that book. I strongly endorse it.
Well, I've read it, and I strongly endorse it. I can, coming from a guy who didn't write it. But hey, this is personal plug Wednesday, I guess. Plug those books, everybody.
There you go.
I mean, I read this. I remember some of these stories from years ago when you first wrote them without any inkling of you're going to put them together in this collection or anything like that, and just reading them on paper. And fantastic story. And just, you've got a fine collection here. There's a, like the commercial says, it's different genres. It's different points of view, different characters, different, there's a variety here for, that'll reach any reader.
Now, let's tie it back to point of view. When I was teaching a class and I was teaching point of view, I was bringing in examples to read aloud to people, and I noticed that I did not have any good examples of second-person future tense. And that's where you're telling a story to a reader or listener, and the story is about the reader or listener, and it's about what is going to happen. So that's kind of a weird, convoluted kind of a mix. And, you know, students were asking me, you know, what are some examples of that? So I wrote a short story in the future tense second person about what's going to happen to you. And I tried to make it ubiquitous so that it pretty much applies to everybody. And that is the last story in Comes This Time to Float. So if you're going to become a student and admirer of point of view, there's some things that I do in that story collection there where I definitely have some fun with point of view on purpose. And then again, that last story exists because I wanted a second person future tense story and didn't already have one. And it turned out to be one of my favorite stories. So get out there and get that book too. Now, what I've got here for this, I printed out that ebook, and it's like 40, almost 50 pages, something like that. And I'm skipping over things, and I'm up to like page 3. So we're obviously not going to do a lot of in-depth covering of stuff today, but let's hit some quick highlights here. A lot of times people say, well, what goes in point of view? What is it that I'm actually looking for? What am I trying to accomplish? So let's break that down. 5 things. There are 5 elements that you're trying to put into point of view. Number 1, the senses. Consider all of the senses. Now, you know, we think of people as having 5 senses, but it's actually more like 15, like balance and intuition and stuff like that too. So all of the senses. And that includes camera angle. So, you know, if you're depicting a chase scene and your point of view character's running, you know, is in the getaway car, as it were, then your camera angles need to be looking back and seeing the police car chasing them, or looking ahead and where are they going to go, and all that kind of stuff. You can't be describing from that person's point of view what the police are seeing, because that's a different point of view. So camera angle is an important part of that. But smell, taste, feeling, all of that kind of stuff, it's all needs to be in there. Don't just say, he looked over there and saw a bird perched on the branch. Say how he feels about that bird or what that bird means to him, and put all of that other stuff in there as well. So that's the senses. The next one is knowledge and history. We'll call this one number two. Once you've designated which character's point of view to use, thoroughly consider what that character knows. For example, clutching little Bethany's hand, he pushed open the door to his lab. His gas spectrochromatograph sat on the table, powered up, its settings suggesting someone had been analyzing crystalline structures. He had not authorized anyone to use his equipment, certainly not to leave it set up and powered. Okay, was that little Bethany's point of view? I would say not, because she wouldn't know what a spectrochromatograph was, and she was probably not noticing that people were analyzing crystalline structures. It's obviously the person holding her hand in that point of view. But if you want it to be from her point of view, you can't use those terms because she does not have that knowledge. She does not have that history. So her description and her point of view would be more like, excited about seeing where Grandpa does his job, Bethany clutched his hand and followed him into a big room. Grandpa stopped and stared at a big machine on the table, all lit like Christmas lights. He got that look on his face like when he's mad about something. Someone's been using my stuff without asking, he said. See how that works? Knowledge and history. Don't have your character know something that the character shouldn't know, because that shatters point of view, just shatters it. Sucks the reader out of the story, tosses them out on the sidewalk, and usually dumps a load of manure on them from a dump truck. So knowledge and history. Now to review. First one was senses. Use all of the senses. Describe what that character's smelling, feeling, tasting, all of that. Second one, knowledge and history. And here's the third one, thoughts. Everything your point of view character is thinking during a scene is fair game for description or direct dialogue style thoughts. Here's an example of description. Only his lab assistant would dare set up the chromatograph, but no respectable tech would leave it powered up. This had to be somebody from outside the department, someone who got interrupted before covering his actions. Okay, that's third person, and it's his attitude, his opinion, and his knowledge. But it could also be first person. Only my lab assistant, he thought, would dare use the graph. Still, he would have put it away. Somebody else must have been in here, and I interrupted him before he could cover up whatever is going on. Now, there are two very common errors when people do that. Maintaining tense works the same as if the thoughts are spoken aloud. Even if the narrative is in the past tense like this, Fred would not think in the past tense. Fred looked across the room and thought, she looked beautiful. He wouldn't think that. Fred looked across the room and thought, she looks beautiful. So thoughts and point of view work the same way as dialogue. You've got to shift the tense as well, because if a person's thinking it, they don't think in the past tense. They're thinking right at what they're thinking. So be careful of that. And here's an example. Fred looked across the room and thought, she looks beautiful. Jumping thoughts might prove an easy shortcut, but that should never occur for any reason. If Fred is thinking a kiss on the hand will impress her, we cannot also hear her thinking, oh, gross, he better not have herpes, because now we're in two heads at the same time. All right, the fourth one. This one's interpretation. Unless the narrator is a designated character with his or her own voice, perceptions, and interpretations, the narration should reflect interpretations appropriate only to each scene's point of view character at that time, in that state of mind. So, your character walks in and sees something going on, and it's a big shock and it's a big surprise. Well, your narrator should not be narrating like this, but it's not a big deal. It's, that happens, and, he shouldn't be worried about that. He is worried about that. He doesn't know what's going on, so your narrator needs to reflect his point of view and talk like, what is this? What's going on? It reminds me of Bean's story. What is that? Which I believe is in Strange Highway. Is that right?
Yeah.
No,
it's Slivers of Life.
Yeah, it is. It's in Slivers of Life.
Yeah.
All right. So, for example, if your point of view is a stereotypical lumber baron surveying newly leased forest land, the narrative should not describe the scene as an exquisite testament to nature's beauty, a treasure best savored in its pristine old-growth purity. Odds are the lumber baron is not thinking that when he's looking at it. Instead, he's likely to be seeing the potential for a valuable high-grade product, the logistics needed to cost-effectively collect and transport the logs. One point of view's act of kindness is another's pushiness. One's good news is another's bad news. One's miracle is confirmation of faith, while another embraces a logical explanation. So, interpretation. That's where the real money starts to come out of this point of view stuff, because you can bring your characters alive by having your narrator describe things in the way the point of view character interprets them. And that's the best way to do it. The best way to do it. That way you are right in that character's head. You're the narrator's in there. Everybody's in there, and you're all going for the ride together. And then the fifth one, plot and information awareness. This one kind of seems obvious, but I've actually seen a lot of people make these mistakes. Your point of view character only knows what is happening in the plot at that point and that that person has been privy to. Now, there's a phrase that just jumps out at me like an alien just, you know, jumping on your face and getting ready to suck all your blood out, and that's, little did he know. little did he know.
Yeah.
In his point of view, he didn't know it, if it's a little did he know situation. So, you know, little did he know she was actually on her way there with a surprise for him, you know, whatever. No, in his point of view, he doesn't get to know that she's on her way there until she knocks on the door. Then we all get to be surprised together. So those are the five things. Your plot and information awareness, how that character interprets, using the senses, having the knowledge and history that that character has, and then being privy to that character's thoughts. Because when you're in a character's head, you get to know everything that person thinks, which is cool. So what do you think, Beam?
I think that's quite accurate. It all sounds right. So, you know, and these are just, I mean, it's these are important things to remember when writing because, you know, as I said, I mean, it couldn't, just forget me being a writer. Coming from a reader's point of view, I mean, this is what makes for the interesting stories is when these things are all aligned and you know, it's well written and all of these mechanics are in place, strong mechanics. I mean, that makes for strong stories. And there's a lot to learn, but this is where you learn from podcasts like this and from books like the G's Writer How To stuff.
Now, if you get the G's Writer How-To on point of view, you'll see that I break this down quite a bit more. I give examples, things like that. You know, like when we say stick to your point of view character's knowledge, I even break that down and give examples too. Like, does your point of view character know names? You know, if you're tempted to say, in walked Lance Thackeray Pettigrew, you know, then, okay, whose point of view are we in, and does that person recognize Lance Thackeray Pettigrew and also know that person's name? You'd be surprised how many times a character who doesn't know another character knows that character just because it's lazy point of view. Recognizing the setting is another example. You know, if last year's fire at the town's mill and recent sightings of ghosts matter to the character, readers will learn as the character learns. So, you know, if you've never been to the mill, then you've never been to the mill. Don't go there knowing a bunch of stuff about it. Stick to that point of view.
Yeah, you're going to a place that you've never been, but your character's talking about how in 1835, you know, Jed Collison broke his leg on that machine over there, and they had to drag him out of there. You've never been there. How do you know that?
Yeah, the one of my favorite new sitcoms is the one called Ghosts, which is on CBS. This woman and her husband inherit an old manor, and it turns out there's a bunch of ghosts staying there. It's fun watching how they work the point of view, too, because these ghosts know things about each other, but they don't know things. There's things they don't know about the living, and there's things that the living don't know about the ghosts, especially since only the woman is the one who can see them and communicate with them. So watching them play with that kind of stuff is fun, too. And even that, it's coming down to interpretation. You know, like one of the ghosts, she remembers when she was a little girl that, you know, the caretaker at the house used to sing to her when she would go to sleep at night, and she couldn't remember his name. And later in the episode, we discover it's the 1,000-year-old Viking ghost that's in the house. And when she was a little girl, he used to sing to her, because little kids sometimes can see and hear these ghosts. And from her point of view, she hated this guy. And, you know, he's not cool at all. He's a 1,000-year-old Viking, and she's like this prim and proper Victorian-era lady. But yet, they had a relationship and have had a relationship that went back hundreds of years and didn't know it. So you got to be careful that when they discover things and learn things, you've got to know what they already knew and what they didn't. And I just enjoy watching that on this show, because they get into some tricky situations, and it's like, okay, let's see how you handle that. And they always do. So you want to roll another commercial, Beam?
We sure can. This one is going to be for the lush Hawaiian novel, Papala Skies.
Ooh, Papala Skies by Stephen Gies. Chicago native Rochelle DeFortier likes to imagine the future. Her world, a series of picture postcards so vivid they sometimes seem real. When a foolish mistake at 13 causes her mother's death, she's sent to a secluded Hawaiian valley. An outsider Haole girl among pigeon-speaking boys who hurl flaming papala spears under the full moon to summon her mother's spirit. After boarding school in a prestigious university back east, the ambitious young woman is torn between chasing new career opportunities, discovering her mother's heritage in a remote French village, and meeting obligations pulling her back to Hawaii. On this island steeped in ancient mythology and modern superstition, Rochelle tests the possibility of sharing pieces of her life with those whose beliefs she barely understands and never intends to embrace. She dives the depths of a pristine coral lagoon, conceals bodies in a subterranean lava tube, and challenges the eruptions of a living volcano, even as she deciphers the truth about her mother's death and struggles to satisfy new debts born of old betrayals. Papala Skies is the story of a young woman who makes all the right choices, only to find herself living an unexpected life. It is about the need to belong and seeking one's own version of truth amid such differing cultures' responses to wrenching loss and abiding grief. It is about yearning for a sense of place, yet having to confront new ways to honor the love of family and friends. Will Rochelle lose what matters most, or might she learn what the smart octopus already knows? Papala Skies by Stephen Gies, proudly published by the Fresh Ink Group.
I like that book too.
Yeah, I do too. In fact, I read that book way back when it was still in manuscript form. That's how long ago it was, and I still remember that. Just, I mean, beautiful, vivid description, and I call it the lush Hawaiian book for a reason, because I mean you could practically see and breathe in and smell the lush vegetation as he describes these wonderful scenes. So, kudos to you on that. We have a comment here on Twitter from Verwayne where he says, "Oh yes, my wife loves the ghost show. I get to watch it by default." I've been there, Duane. I was married back in the 1990s when a show called Beverly Hills 90210 was on, and my ex-wife loved that show, so I got stuck watching that every week. And you start to get into the character just by default, so I know what was going on that show, even though I wasn't a fan. I knew what was going on.
Well, I'm so old. I come back from the one TV in the house in the living room days, and you know, if you got a little sister and the Partridge Family's coming on, you're gonna watch the Partridge Family, or go outside, you know.
Yeah, I was a little kid myself when the Partridge Family was on, and I used to like that show, the Brady Bunch. Man, there was some good stuff there.
Yeah. Now, on this point of view stuff, I'm just flipping through pages here, and there's so many examples and techniques and little tricks and stuff that you can do, especially if you've kind of painted yourself into a corner, to use the cliche, and you need to know how to make this adjustment so that you can get back in line to have your point of view working for you instead of against you. So I encourage you to go through those. There's one thing in particular that is a very common thing, and that's people ask about it. How do you tell us what's going on in other people's heads in a scene where you really do want to know, but you don't want to have to do a scene break and break out a separate scene or whatever? And that's interpreting other points of view. So, for example, you've got people who work on a shop floor, and then there's a foreman's office up above you where you got to go up the stairs, and there's a window up there, and you can see out over the floor. Now, what's going on here is there's, you know, the company's going out of business or being taken over or something's happening, and the workers are all uneasy, everybody's nervous, and they're seeing these people they don't recognize coming into the plant and looking around and stuff like that. So now you've got a scene where somebody goes on a tour of this production shop, and then they're going to go up, and you're going to be in their point of view up in the foreman's office, but you want to interpret what are the people thinking. So you just observe, give the information, give the details. You know, if you're in Bethany's head, you don't want to say Bob was nervous. You just want to have Bethany look over and watch and see Bob fidgeting, you know, pulling it a string on his things, on his shirt, or, you know, his eyes darting around the room and checking his watch or whatever. You paint the picture that Bethany sees, and then you let Bethany interpret it, and bam, we know what's going on with this other guy without breaking Bethany's point of view. So that example I just gave you with the shop. Boss Horton dreaded leading the owner on this tour of the production shop. It always made the crew uneasy, sparking rumors of doom and gloom. As the pair stepped outside his office, the workers fell quiet, their eyes darting around the room before fixating back on their work. Uneasy murmurings filtered among the machines. They did not like this unexpected tour. They did not like it one bit. Now, see, I never went into anybody's head down there on the shop floor, but I let the character, whose point of view you were in, observe and interpret and come to the conclusion, hey, they didn't like this. They didn't like this at all. And that's perfectly valid. Your characters are going to interpret what other people are thinking, feeling, their motivations, their desires, and even trying to decide how much knowledge they have. So don't be afraid to do that. Just make sure you keep it in that point of view.
Yeah. And if done right, man, you can wow a lot of people.
Yeah. Now, I promised that I would mention animal point of view. I've got a section here explaining different techniques for doing things from an animal's point of view, but I'll just read you just a quick paragraph of an example. Food feeding lady driving away. Ruff jumps up to a spot at the window. Soap-smelling kid across the street plays wheels on foot. Chipmunk runs around in Ruff's territory. Need to get out. Pee some more. Prove who lives here. Car coming. Big car. Coming. Boom. Going by. Woof, 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 woof. Tail wagging. Chase them off. They come, but they always run, afraid of Ruff. Oh, 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 ooh. New dog. Sniff, sniff. Can't tell male or female yet. It's got a fat man on a leash. Must be a food feeder. Going by, going by. Arg! Another butt getting away unsniffed.
Comedy.
Well, you know.
Comedy from the dog's point of view.
Well, we got what was on the dog's mind, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Now, as we run out of time here, I want to mention just one more big concept. And if you buy the ebook, it's the whole, like, second half. Actually, there's a third section here about what you can do to change, make changes and fixes and stuff. But the whole middle section of this is called POV, duh, and it's unnecessary point of view reminders. I coined that term, like, 30 years ago, and I have never seen anybody else ever talk about it, even the concept, and I've never seen another term for it, and I've never come up with a better term. So you POVers, unnecessary point of view reminders, is kind of where it is right now. A you POVer is when you tell the readers whose point of view you're in unnecessarily. Now, I'm going to read you some examples, and let's look for the tells. And I'll give you a hint. There's like a couple in every sentence. Marty peeked out his front door and saw two tattooed teenagers on the sidewalk. He noticed they looked jittery. A parked car could be seen, which a third teen leaned against. Marty recalled riding in the same kind of car several years before, and he remembered how luxurious it felt. He could hear birds chirping overhead, but he detected a note of franticness in their songs. That's when he caught a whiff of smoke. He thought it smelled like drugs, and he felt angry about the teens' invasion of his neighborhood. It looked to him like they did not care that they were intruding on someone else's property. He considered the idea that they had probably stolen that car. Okay. Now, when you say Marty peeked out his front door and saw two tattooed teenagers on the sidewalk, I don't need to be told he saw it, because if he peeked out the door and you tell me there's two teenagers out there and I'm in his point of view, duh. You see it? He noticed they looked jittery. How about they looked jittery? A parked car could be seen, which a third teen leaned against. Marty recalled riding in the same car several years before. He remembered how luxurious it felt. He could hear birds chirp. He thought it smelled like drugs. He felt angry. It looked to him. You see that? Every bit of that is reminders that were in his point of view, and we don't need any of them. So let's try switching it to having the things that each sentence is about become the subject and let it have its own verb. Marty peeked out his front door. Two jittery teenagers stood on the sidewalk. A third teen leaned against a parked car, a luxurious model Marty once rode in several years before. Birds chirped frantically overhead. Smoke with the odor of drugs wafted about, an infuriating invasion of the neighborhood. Those teens didn't care about intruding on someone else's property. They probably stole that car. You see that? We got rid of every one of the reminders and started putting some interpretation in there.
And it made the telling of it even more interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's beef it up. Marty peeked out his front door for a better look at the intruders. Now, see, I'm choosing words that Marty would choose for how he feels about these people. A couple of jittery teenagers loitered suspiciously on the sidewalk, clearly up to no good. A third teen leaned against one of those luxury cars, the kind of which Marty only once had the privilege to ride. Birds chirped frantically overhead as if warning neighbors to beware of such thugs. Smoke wafted about, likely drugs perniciously invading what used to be a safe, friendly neighborhood. Those hoodlums didn't care about intruding on others' property. They probably even stole that car and no telling what else. See it?
Yeah.
Way cool examples in here in the book, but I'm telling you, they leap out at me. When I'm reading a story and I'm getting these, he saw, he looked out the window and saw, that kind of stuff. It's like, man, why are you wasting words telling me this stuff? Because if I'm in his head, if you tell me there's a bird on a branch outside the window, he got to be looking at it or I wouldn't know, or you wouldn't be able to tell me, because in his point of view, if he's not seeing it or aware of it, you're not allowed to tell it. I'm going to give you one more quick example here. This is unnecessary action description, which intrudes on point of view. Brent returned to the fire-damaged home where he had spent his childhood. He stepped through the front door and saw the familiar front room. I hope you're noticing these, and saw the familiar front room. Its walls and ceiling burned through to the studs. He could smell smoke in the air, even weeks after the fire. He walked into the kitchen and discovered how the damage concentrated where the fire had started on the stove. He looked underneath the charred hulk and saw buckled floorboards nearly breaking through. He went to the family room. You notice how I'm telling you all the details about he went here and he looked there and all that kind of stuff? I'm going to say that you don't need him. He went to the family room where he listened to eerie silence, replacing years of blasting TV and childish noise. He walked upstairs and found the bathroom caked in smoky soot. He looked into the cracked, heat-warped mirror and observed his image, now looking splintered and bloated. Going down the hallway, he went into his old bedroom and noticed that the fluorescent desk light had shattered. Now, if you buy the book, you'll see that I rewrite that scene like four or five different ways, showing you different techniques that you can use. Let me just jump to one last one here. This is where I got rid of all the unnecessary action and all the unnecessary reminders, both of which were only there to remind me whose point of view we're in. Brent walked through his fire-damaged childhood home. The walls and ceiling of the familiar front room had burned through to the studs. Weeks after the fire, smoke still permeated the air. The damage concentrated where the fire had started at the kitchen stove, now a charred hulk, nearly breaking through the buckling floorboards. Eerie silence in the family room replaced years of blasting TV and childish noise. Smoky soot layered the upstairs bathroom where the giant mirror, warped and cracked by heat, splintered and bloated his image. The fluorescent desk light in his bedroom had shattered. You notice never in that paragraph did I ever have him move his feet or go to another room or anything like that. Instead, I just described what he was seeing in each room, and you had no choice but to walk him to each room because how else is he going to see them? Kind of obvious. Well,
yeah.
Listeners, we're just about out of time here. As I said, we didn't really get to cover very much of this, but I hope I gave you enough to start thinking about, come up with some questions, take a look at the in more detailed examples that are in that how-to book, and don't be afraid to shoot me a note sometime and show me some examples of your work or ask some questions about that as well.
Yeah, and I want to just kind of slip in here. The last stuff that you were reading there, that also deals with the whole show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so important. That's, you know, I see that a lot. And I just spoke with this woman who's writing her first novel on that, and I gave her some pointers on that. So, you know, hopefully she picks up and crosses the end zone into the end zone with it and writes a fine first novel. Now,
all right, so let's wrap with my contact info. I'm on Twitter, Stephen G's, Instagram, Stephen G's Writer, I think, Facebook, Gary Stephen G's. But go to freshinkgroup.com, use the contact form. I see those constantly. So send me a note to the contact form at freshinkgroup.com. And I appreciate you spreading the word, talking about my books, and posting those 5-star, 6-star, 8-star reviews.
Yeah, and the G's Writers website, that's a cool website because Stephen's got other really good writers over there that are offering points of view on tips and things like, not point of view like we're talking about tonight, but tips basically on issues dealing with writing. So you got a whole crew of people over there that you can learn, and it's a free site, or you can pay the $2 and get a copy of Stephen's books and whatnot. Now, listeners, please remember to share this show from the archives. Follow up with questions to Stephen G on the Fresh Ink Group website if you have questions that you want to follow up with. There's a contact form, and Stephen will see you.
And if you do get any of those How to G's Writer books, make sure you leave a review over there too, because they only have a couple of reviews. Now,
next week
we've got novelist and cliche aficionado James Welpley, and then February 2nd.
And following that, we got Aichen Chang Lim. She is a novelist, a memoirist, and an all-around wonderful person. I've spoken to her in the past, so looking forward to speaking to her again.
February 9th, we've got Abigail Hugeni, the author of There Must Be Something in the Water, the descendants of slaves who grew up in Green Pond, South Carolina, went on to accomplish great things. So we're looking forward to having Abigail.
And after that, we have a return guest, Mr. Carlisle Toms. He will be coming in promoting his newest book, The Calling Dream.
And then February 23rd, Tampa area singer-songwriter Frankie Ray is going to be our guest, and she's going to bring some songs, and we're going to have some fun.
Yeah, and then soon after that, Patricia A. Guthrie, she will be in here with her Eerie Charms short story collection, and probably talking a little bit about Legacy of Danger as well, another recent release. And then the Carter's Crossover event on March 23rd, that will be a fun time. So be sure to tune in for that. And
yep.
Thank you to everybody who called in and who joined the conversation on Twitter and listened to Stephen give a master class on Point of View tonight.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
See you next week, everybody. Have a safe week.
You've been a part of Voice of Indie, a production of Fresh Ink Group. spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.